Now, we as Seventh-day Adventists had some discussion about this from about 1860s on, and there for a while, after maybe 1880 till about 1970, it was something that was talked about a lot in our church, something that was promoted. And then, for reasons not clear to me, it stopped being given any emphasis. And in fact, now if you do the Value Genesis, the Adventist Health Study, I think is what it's called, you will find that less than 50% of Adventists are now vegetarians. So I just wanted to go over to our roots and remind us of the information that we already had a long, long time ago. It says, for those who are looking for the coming of the Lord, for those who are called to be laborers in his vineyard, for all who are fitting themselves for a place in the everlasting kingdom, how important that the brain be clear and the body as free as possible from disease. Now, hygienic reform was her way of talking about the meat. Okay, so it's going on. It says, you know not the danger of eating meat merely because your appetite craves it. By partaking of this diet, man places in his mouth that which stimulates unholy passions. Unhallowed emotions fill the mind, and the spiritual eyesight is beclouded. For the tendency of self-gratification is to corrupt the taste and the judgment. Notice judgment here. By furnishing your table with this kind of food, you go counter to the will of God. A condition of things is brought about which will lead to a disregard of the precepts of God's law. Now, before we knew all this DNA stuff, people used to read that. I remember when I was in the 80s, people would use this as prime evidence that obviously this lady didn't know what she was talking about. A lot of chortling. Well, you eat the meat, it's digested in your... They talk about the enzymes, the proteases that are in your gut, and you that's totally impossible. Obviously, she didn't know what she was talking about. Or did she? Remember we talked about noramic acid last 2 weeks ago and how it's the main component for forming a dendrite axon connection in your brain? And a study done by knowing the new Ellen White came to the conclusion that if you eat a diet that's got a lot of GC in it, you're going to be dumber. That's using very simple language. You're not going to be as smart as you would be if you didn't. And guess which part is most affected? The neurons which have the highest number of connections are in the prefrontal cortex, where you do your judgment, where you do your critical thinking. Those neurons have an average of 100,000 connections, whereas one toward the base of the brain may only have 20,000, 10,000 to 20,000 connections. So if you take the whole brain and you just average them all out, you're going to get 50,000 connections on average between one neuron and another, which is absolutely incredible, because you have a billion neurons, rough give or take, and if you figure out that they have, on average, 50,000 connections, and that those connections change every day, if you do a statistical analysis of that, you will find out that you come out with virtually infinity as far as what the brain is able to connect and to... The infinity is the number of connections you can come up with. Because each time you make one new connection, you have to do the whole math all over again for the possibilities of what the new connections do. And when all of these talk to each other, you see one connection can change 100,000 pathways. Because there will be 100,000 signals coming in through 50 nerves that are connected in a certain way. So one of them now makes a new connection, and now you've got a whole new change. Remember one paper where I showed you that one neuron changing in the brain has profound effect on the entire brain's ability to function. We don't... People who drink, for instance, say, hey, look, if I lose 10,000 neurons, no big deal, I got a billion. What they don't realize is every one of those guys, in one way or another, is connected to the other and talks with the other and is working together synergistically to somehow come up with thought and make you who you are. And losing any of them is a big deal. Just go talk to an Alzheimer's patient. Because they still have most of theirs. They've just lost a certain percentage, and that's what you get. Or go talk to an NFL football player. They're now suing the NFL because all of them are getting dementia at a very early age because of all the blows to the head. They lost some neurons with each one of those concussions. Not a stupendous number compared to the billion, but guess what? You don't have to lose big numbers in order to be debilitated. There is an alarming lethargy shown on the subject of unconscious sensualism. It is customary to eat the flesh of dead animals. The human family is under the despotism of custom and false education, of hereditary and cultivated habits. Appetite reigns as a king over the mind and reason. The animal propensities are allowed to become a controlling power, and proportionately as nature's laws are transgressed, physical sufferings and disease of every stripe and type is seen. Every transgression of the laws of physical life is a transgression of the law of God. We always think of the law of God as being the Ten Commandments. We are very remiss in making it far too small. I would suggest to you that we break his law anytime we in any way desecrate anything he's made, whether it's in ourselves or someone else. Which of course would then include killing someone or telling gossip about someone, or you go down the line. And if you don't have any respect for him in the first place, number one, you aren't going to worry about the other nine. They become immaterial. Those who eat too largely and those who eat unhealthful food bring trouble upon themselves, unfitting themselves for the service of God. It is dangerous to eat meat, for animals are suffering from many deadly diseases. We just talked about the pig, didn't we, with the transposable element that causes leukemia in pigs, and they're finding that in humans when they do the xenotransplants. Now they're wondering, are the humans going to get lymphoma or leukemia? Those who persist in eating the flesh of animals sacrifice spirituality to a perverted appetite. Their bodies become full of diseases. Now, I threw this in simply to tell you that this is from the American Dietetic Association. It was printed in 2009. It was part of a bulletin they put out. And what I want to say is that it says features of a vegetarian diet that may reduce risk of chronic disease include lower intakes of saturated fat and cholesterol and higher intakes of fruits, vegetables, whole grains, nuts, soy products, fiber, and photochemicals. The variability of dietary practices among vegetarians makes individual assessment of dietary adequacy essential. And it says, in addition to assessing dietary adequacy, food and nutritional professionals can also play a key role in educating vegetarians about the source of specific nutrients, food purchase and preparation, and the dietary modifications to meet their needs. What I thought I was going to read and what's included here and it's up higher is that it says that it is, it's the first sentence. It is the position of the American Dietetic Association that appropriately planned vegetarian diets, including total vegetarian or vegan diets, are healthful, nutritionally adequate, and may provide health benefits in the prevention of treatment and certain diseases.
Look where it came from.
Yes, it was put out from Barry and Sanders University, but they had the blessing of, they had a meeting up there of the American Dietetic Association, and they got this passed, so it wasn't just our brethren up north, it was the whole American Dietetic Association. You're going to hear people tell you, well, you can't be a vegan, plant-based, or you can't be a vegetarian and be healthy. We have now evidence from people who aren't even connected with our church that say, yeah, in fact, it's probably better for you. All right, I'll start taking supplements, okay? Before I get into this, I want to say one other thing. What if you were given the opportunity to be the purchasing agent for the United States Army? Okay? You're going to be the purchasing person for the United States Army. And your job is to go out and procure all of the essential means that are needed by the army to function. Now, what would you do? Would you sit down in your office and you go, oh, well, this is just overwhelming. I really don't like any of this anyway. I think what I'll do is I'll just make sure they get plenty of fuel. I'm just going to send them fuel. You know, if they want more ammunition, well, I'll see what I can do. More guns. You need some transport vehicles? Well, maybe we can get some for you next week. And you need water? Yeah, I guess we need to get that too. But we'll be sending you hourly shipments of fuel. Fuel, fuel, fuel. And after about 2 months, you start getting stuff, information back from the field that says, look, we're having to build huge depots to put all this gasoline and oil that you're sending us. We're not even asking for that. You keep sending us all of this fuel, and what we need is guns. We need bullets. We need bulletproof vests. We need helmets. We need boots. We need clothing. We need tents. And all you do is send us fuel. Fuel, fuel, fuel. The trucks just are lined up. Every time they come in, that's all they have. They dump their fuel. Every now and then they give us a few grenades, and one time we got a little shuffling of some rifles, but there was no ammunition. How long would you keep your job?
Well, it's the U.S. Army, probably a long time.
I thought someone would say that, and I figured that. How long should you keep your job? That's that. Thank you, I will reword it. How long should you keep your job? Folks, you have 100 trillion army that you are in charge of every day. You have 100 trillion cells. They work for you. They depend upon you. They have no way on their own of going out and getting what they need. They have to depend on you and you alone. And if all you do is send them fuel in the form of high fructose syrup, or sugar, or white bleached flour, you are not sending them anything else they need. You're just sending them fuel, 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 and you're forcing them to build these huge containers because the fuel comes in, they don't know what to do with it, so they make what is called lipocells, which are fat cells, and they put the fuel in there. And they keep thinking, when are you going to send us something we really need? We need a bunch of other stuff. We've got enough fuel now that we could probably go for 10 years. But what we don't have is folate, and we don't have iron, and we don't have chromium, and we don't have zinc, and we don't have certain essential amino acids, and we don't have all... And all you send us is glucose. Is it any wonder that the system begins to send up messages, we need something more, and you go, oh, I'm hungry. Well, where's the donuts? They work for you. And if they quit, you're in a heap big trouble. All right, let's go on to the... Can we still eat our donuts every day and our high fructose sugar and our Little Debbies? I'm always so proud. It's a fight between Little Debbies and what's the other make of the little girl? Not Little Debbies, but the what?
Twinkies.
It's a fight between those two companies as who can get the most calories and refined product into one little area per cubic centimeter. And the winner, of course, gets the most sales. And I'm so proud that one of our own, the head of Little Debbie's, is winning. Okay, now that we've taken a moment to gloat and have a good time, let's get back to business, congratulating ourselves with our apparent success. What about supplements? Can you get by with just eating this high fuel stuff that has nothing in it, absolutely nothing else that the cell needs? All of us have enough fuel to last for an indefinite period of time here. What we don't have, what the cells aren't getting, is the basic stuff that makes, that takes care of the genome and keeps the cell running. Fuel is important, but we've way overdone the fuel, and so well could we say, well, I'd still like to eat my donuts, and I'd still like to have my Twinkies, and I would like to finish off with the Little Debbie oatmeal cake in the evening, and that would be my dinner, and I'd like a little ice cream there, and I'll throw some strawberries on, so then I know I'm getting my fruit. Can we get by this problem of what is called empty calories, because that's what they are, by taking food supplements? We can trick the system. We can say, okay, we're just going to send you to the army, and making that analogy, we're going to send you 100,000 tanks. And you'll have the fuel, so you're fine. Now, the fact that there aren't any arterial cells for the tanks, of course, is immaterial. You send them all the tanks. Now, they can drive around and look real important, but they can't do a darn thing besides drive around. So this is what we're going to look at now. Or we're going to send them some tanks, or we're going to send them some rifles, just high concentrated amounts, and see if we can get by that way. That way we can continue our diet of empty calories and get away with it. This is a folic acid. I'm going to read this. An article published in October 2007 issue of the British Journal of Nutrition warns that fortifying flour with folic acid, a move intended to prevent neural tube deficits among mothers who eat the flour, when the baby is developing between 4 and 6 weeks in the mother's womb, as when the neural tube is formed that ends up becoming the central nervous system, either the brain and the spinal cord, and if they need to have folate at that time. If they don't, you get things like spina bifida and other problems dealing with the CNS. And if they're severe enough, the baby will abort. So the idea was, well, we'll start putting folate in all of the flour. That way we won't be getting any of these problems in the mothers in Great Britain, because when these babies are born and they have multiple genetic defects, of course, everybody pays. So, great idea. We're going to make sure everybody gets folate. Unlike the natural folates found in leafy green vegetables, which are digested in the gut, synthetic supplements are now believed to be metabolized in the liver. Did you catch that? In other words, if we give them, we put it in on the flour. We just put some folate on, and it's included in the flour, so when they eat a piece of bread, they're getting folate. Okay? That folate gets into the system, all right, but it goes right into the bloodstream where it heads to the liver, and when it gets to the liver, it gets conjugated into a new chemical. It has to go to the liver first, because all of the blood flow from the gut goes to the liver before it enters the rest of the body. It comes through the portal system into the liver. So it's going to be metabolized before it can get to the rest of the body, to this new active folate. Whereas if you eat it in the leafy green vegetables where it naturally occurs, something different happens. It's absorbed into the endothelial cell of our guts, and there it is metabolized, or it's conjugated, something is put onto it, and then it enters the bloodstream, but it's a different chemical than what happens if you bypass that system and you just put it in the flour and it goes to the liver. What the liver does with it is different than what the mucosal cells do with it. But the mucosal cells will only do what they do to that folate molecule if they have other chemicals that are present in the green leafy vegetable. Without that, it doesn't happen. So you got to get it with the green leafy vegetable to get this, the folate from the gut. Whereas the folate that's just put in with the flour, there's no green leafy vegetables around, so it goes right to the liver, it's made into something else. Well, guess what they found out? The stuff that goes to the liver ends up doing bad things in your body. It doesn't do what it was supposed to do. In fact, it does bad things. The only way you're going to get that folate to do what it's supposed to do is if it's absorbed into the intestinal mucosa, where it receives the proper modification that makes it just what the body needs. transposable elements, targets for early nutritional effects of epigenetic gene regulation. Instead of reading this to you, because I can read this through and it's gobbledygook and I have to stop and then translate for you anyway, let's go right to the translation, okay? I think by now, after 7 weeks, you probably trust me that I'm not making the stuff up. So at this point, I'm going to take a leap of faith and just start telling you what's there and hope you believe me, because for the last 6.5 lectures, I've painstakingly read it all and translated it to you, okay? Leap of faith. We'll see if it harms me. Now, have you ever heard of the Agouti mice? The Agouti mice were recently, about a month or 6 weeks ago, they were in, I think it was Time Magazine or U.S. News and World Report, it was talking about epigenetics. What they discovered is they've got a strain of mice where the mothers are big and fat and yellow fur, and they all have diabetes and they die young. They're called Agouti mice. Okay, because they have... what happens in their genome is they have a transposable element that sits right next to the Agouti gene, and that transposable element, remember those, we keep talking about it. Isn't it funny how they pop up everywhere? This transposable element shuts down the gene which is right next to it, which is called the Agouti gene, and I suspect it was named for a guy or a woman by the name of Agouti. That's how they got the name. So there, that's the Agouti gene is sitting here. A transposable element comes, it's a repressor part. Remember we talked about transposable elements can stop coding, they can cut DNA out, flip it around, reinsert it, they can make you read antisense, they can make you read from backwards to forwards, they can do anything they want in the genome. They've hijacked the system. So this transposable element in the mouse is right next to the Agouti gene, and what it does is it shuts it down. It's a repressor. It says you're not going to function. When that happens, the messenger RNA that would normally be translated or transcribed from that Agouti gene doesn't get transcribed, and the result is the mothers are obese, they all have diabetes, and they all die young. So, what they said is, all right, wonder what would happen if we take those mothers and we fed them some folate. Now, folate, B12, and choline are needed to not only help the neurotube develop of humans when they're between 4 and 6 weeks gestational age, but they're also required for the methylation enzymes, the enzymes that go in and methylate the DNA. Remember, that means locking it down. So the guys that go around and lock down the DNA have to have folate and B12. So what happens was they said, okay, we're going to give these mothers some, I'm not going to read this to you, it's gobbledygook, but I want to go to the pictures. Here are the pictures. We're going to give these mothers some folate and see what happens. And sure enough, if they gave the mother no folate, these are pups, if they gave the mother no folate, these are all at the same age. Notice these are fatter than the brown ones. The yellow ones are fatter than the brown ones. They gave them no folate, the pups look like that. They gave them a little bit of folate, they look like this. Looks pretty much the same. I can't really tell the difference. A little more folate, notice you're starting to get a little brown now. This brown is the color that these mice should be. The yellow is indicating that the Agouti gene is not being expressed. Then they give more folate, and then they give a lot of folate. And if they give a lot of folate, the pups she has will be normal. They won't be Agouti. They have a dark coat. They don't get diabetes. They live a long time, way longer than their mom. They run around. They don't have arthritis. It's great. Everything's controlled. So when they first came across this, they went, fantastic. That's probably what promoted the guys in England, prompted the people in England to put this in their flour, which they now are realizing they shouldn't. I don't know. I'm guessing they've taken it out. I don't know that for a fact. My guess is they have. So they said, okay, this is great. We're going to start feeding these, and we're going to see what happens to the pups. We're going to give them some folate and see what happens. Well, guess what happened? The ones what they got, the pups from the mothers, they got the most folate. As they lived a longer life, they also developed cancers, multiple different types of cancers, sarcomas and other problems. Whereas if you took some cups from mothers who had never been a goody, and you still fed them some they were at the control. They weren't fed any folate. They did not develop these same cancers. So when they went ahead and looked at it, what they found out was, giving these mom folate, it went to the rat's liver, it was made into a very active form, that went around and just started methylating everything in the mom's genome. Yep, it methylated the repressor, all right, that was next to the agouti gene, so the agouti gene could be expressed. But it methylated other repressor genes, it repressed other genes that stopped them from having cancer. So there you go again. You got to get the folate in the package it was originally packaged in. Or it doesn't work. And worse, it'll do bad stuff. It overworks. There's no brakes on it. So is anything safe? Or shall we all end it? Should we be just like... You can all call me Jim Jones here. I know. I don't know what you're...
So should we all stop taking our multivitamins?
I'm not going to be the one that's going to tell you to do that, but where was the article you just showed me in the last 2 days about why you shouldn't take multivitamins?
Nature.
It was in Nature, which is our most...
It was actually reported in the proceedings in the National Academy.
National Academy of Sciences proceedings, and it was put out in the last, wasn't it, month?
A couple months, yeah.
And it was because it's fairly new, and you showed it to me and said, hey, look at this, and I just had a chance to read over the abstract. They're saying don't. Don't even hear it from me. I'm the messenger. I'm simply telling you what the National Academy of Sciences is saying. Okay, you can determine whether they're trustworthy or not. I'm just the conduit, so if someone quits taking vitamins and then comes down with something, don't come knocking at my door. I'm simply telling you...
There's information. The gist of the article was that you can actually do detrimental effects by taking multivitamins because you get an excessive amount and not in the natural form that it was created to be.
Makes sense.
Yeah. And that's what's really surprising about some of these things.
The minerals the same?
Minerals?
They didn't discuss that. It's specifically vitamin supplements was this article as well. I'm not sure.
People who are vegetarian, especially people who are plant-based, probably need to augment their diet with some zinc. But that's the only one.
What about vitamin D?
That's a vitamin, it's not a mineral.
I know.
Yeah. Vitamin D is the only vitamin that's been shown to be efficacious when you take it in supplemental form. Because you normally, they say the government says that you should have 600 to 800 units a day, and so they say, well, you should probably take 1,000 a day. But that's all guesswork. I'll admit to something, I take 5,000 a day. That doesn't mean you should. I have no scientific reason to tell you why I take 5,000, except that vitamin D is a very active anti-cancer component, and it does a number of other things too, but they've done eloquent studies of people in places like Sweden, where the cancer rate, where they don't get a lot of sun and they don't take vitamin D, and the cancer rates and how they fluctuate with sun exposure, and it's pretty convincing. And people 55 and above lose their ability to have the sunlight convert and make the active form D3. They lose that ability. At some point thereafter, it gets less and less and less and less. So that on average, after 55, you probably should be thinking about taking something there. Yeah.
What about things like enzymes and coenzymes?
You know, I have not done a lot of study on those because I am a firm believer after what I've read and gone through, and Mike, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but if you eat a wide variety of vegetables and fruits, you don't need anything more. With the possible exception of zinc, maybe. You're going to get everything.
That's assuming somebody doesn't have pancreatitis.
Yes. So I'm assuming you've got no other medical conditions.
I'm going to speak as a biochemist, okay? First of all, an enzyme is a protein, and it's going to be broken down in your stomach in most cases. Secondly, your things like your B vitamins and whatnot, those are coenzymes. So chances are you're not gaining anything based on the kinds of stuff he's talking about.
The reason I asked is because when my husband is the first time he developed scar tissue in his lungs and nearly died in his own CO2 because he couldn't get enough oxygen in and CO2 out. And he was told that he had about three weeks to a month to live because once that scar tissue hardens, it never regenerates. And I have read coenzyme Q10 helped the lung and the heart to regenerate.
Okay, but you're getting very specific about a particular coenzyme, not coenzymes in general.
Okay.
And the other thing about coenzyme Q10, I used to take it, I quit taking it when a number of literature articles have come out that shows it can be very detrimental, and in certain cancers it promotes it. So that's when I started realizing, wait a minute, this idea of just picking up supplements isn't good. In fact, the only thing they really kind of suggested for is people in congestive heart failure. Because it helps to, they think, make the myocardial cells, which don't increase in number, but they make the ones you do have, the actin and myosin, to work better. So, and I'm just telling you what the present theory is, that I've, at least the most recent stuff. And I've come away with the conclusion that everything was packaged together in, as an entire... it'll be redundant. It's an entire package. All of the parts and everything that's needed for what you're going to get from that package is present in the exact ratios that are needed so that your system can take it in and utilize it correctly. When you start taking things out of that package and just sending them in, you can get yourself into trouble. Every time, I don't know. I'm not going to speak and say every time, but I certainly made the point for folate. That is now accepted, and there's others I could have brought, but it's already almost 9 o'clock, and I got three more slides to get to, and I got to get to them. But so my point to you is, I personally believe, I am convinced, with the possible exception of zinc, and if you're going to be plant-based and do that and not get a wide variety of vegetables, possibly B12. Saving those two, you should not eat anything. And if you get a large array of both fruits and vegetables, you shouldn't eat either. But people tend to eat what they like the most, broccoli, 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 and they don't have Brussels sprouts. And the problem is, you got to eat across the board if you're going to get everything, because each one of these has strengths and weaknesses that are complemented by the other. I'm sure you've heard, if you eat brown rice and beans at every meal, you'll get all your essential amino acids. But you only eat brown rice, or you don't make it up with something else that you'll get from the lagoons, you won't. That's a simple illustration of a broader concept I'm trying to get across with all of the multiple cofactors and coenzymes and all of those things you're talking with. I'm saying you can get them, and if you get them in their natural package, they're going to work. If you don't get them in the natural package, I'm going to suggest to you they probably won't work and possibly will cause a problem. So, what about plants? I got here, I want to tell you, plants have a wonderful thing. It says, DNA suitable for digestion and restriction endonucleases has been isolated from a plant, tobacco. A plant high in polyphenolic compounds and several other plant taxia using the method presented in this paper. They presented a long paper method in this paper trying to get to the DNA in plants. It's so difficult, it's almost impossible. You have to go through a multi-step process before you can extract enough of the DNA that means anything. Because it says here, isolation of highly purified plant DNA is notoriously difficult, particularly from plants high in polyphenolic compounds, diphenols. Plants and fruits have an array of chemicals put under polyphenolic compounds, that's the mother name of all, of the family name, that latch onto the DNA that's in plants and keeps it locked up and unavailable for your body to absorb. And I told you earlier, that's why people in the China study who ate meat but ate a lot of vegetables had less cancer than those who just ate a lot of meat. I'm going to suggest to you that that's, at least this is one of the causes. Probably others too, because of other things they would be getting from the plants. Now, allowing polyphenols to become oxidized and irreversibly react with the protein and nucleic acid fractions. They irreversibly bind on. Because polyphenolic complexes appear to form very quickly after damage to the leaves, treatment of leaves prior to isolation is critical. The leaves should not be cut or bruised in any way prior to maceration in dry ice. In other words, if you take a leaf, if you take a piece of spinach, and you put it in your mouth and you start to chew it, you immediately will lock up the DNA. Forget, you're not going to be able to extract any of it. If you were a scientist and you said, okay, I'm going to get some DNA, I'm going to chew it in my mouth here real quick, get into small pieces, and I'm going to put it into my extraction setup, and I'm going to get some out, you will not get any. You have to go jump through hoops before the leaf is even touched or in any way perturbed. You have to start giving certain chemical reagents in there to get in there and counteract these phenols so that you can get to that DNA. And then this paper just goes, is an eloquent paper talking about the fact that people who have autoimmune disease like rheumatoid arthritis, SLE, systemic lupus erythematosus, Berger syndrome, there's a whole list of them. If they take them off of a meat diet and put them onto a plant-based diet, some of them go into remission, but almost all of them have a great decrease in the amount of symptoms they have. And it goes back to probably the noramic acid, but it also goes back to transposable ailments, because remember way back, like lecture 3, all of autoimmune diseases have as their etiology transposable ailments. Which one do you want me to read? It says, as the berry intake was threefold compared to controls, the intake of polyphenolic compounds like quercetin, myrcetin, and camphorol was much higher than in the omnivorous controls. All of those three chemicals that I stumbled over work to decrease inflammation and possibly have some even effect on the transposable ailments that were causing this in the first place, as far as getting them under control, at least taking care of any transcription that comes from it.
These are the modulators of the
NF. Right. Remember we talked about the NF-kappa-B protein? Remember way back to the first lecture, and I had it sitting right here, and it had all the stuff on top and on the bottom, and I said if you push it over, it goes into inflammation. Well, those guys work to keep that protein sitting right there in the middle where it's supposed to. The present study is the first report of a very rapid, extensive, irreversible binding of... forgot what EA stood for. To DNA. Yes, it's like it was one of the proteins. To DNA in a human epithelial cell during the course of its enteric absorption. In a previous study, we demonstrated irreversible binding of a flavonoid, quercetin, also to DNA in caco-2 cells. The binding of EA, which is a protein, it's like a phenol, that binds to the DNA. To DNA is as much as 500 times higher than for quercetin. They were just showing you the different molecules that they come up with that will bind to the DNA that are present in fruits and vegetables. You can eat all of them you ever could want, and you will not absorb any transportable elements from either one of them, period, guaranteed. That guarantee is absolutely absent when you're talking meat. it's not there.
Does this also hold true for
nuts?
Genetically,
yes. That's what Monsanto says. I don't know the answer to that. And we talked about that. And this is just talking about there. This slide shows you all of the different naturally occurring grains, fruits, and roots, or vegetables. And what each one of them carries, they all carry something, some of them more than one, but they all carry some unique chemicals which help to not only grab all of the DNA that comes with it, but also works on the kappa B protein that we talked about, the NF kappa B protein. They all have effects to keep it from pushing on to the inflammatory side. They have different chemicals, and the more chemicals that you put in, the better chance you are that you're going to keep everything in your body from going into the inflammatory state. And we showed you last time around what that inflammatory state is. Bad news, bad news, bad news. Nothing good about it. Nothing.
What's the source of that?
This is Pharmaceutical Research, Volume 25, Number 9, September 2008. I'll read it to you again. Pharmaceutical Research, Volume 25, Number 9, September 2008. Yeah, I didn't know, like, cumin and some of that's, it's, cumin does such great stuff. We could spend 20 minutes on that. We're not, don't worry, we're not going to do it. Don't head for the door. But spices, wouldn't that be just like God to make spices which make the foods taste so well, carry special stuff you're not going to get anywhere else? They have anti-cancer, anti-inflammation.
How much do you have to use of it to get
Not much. Right? With the cumin, you don't need much at all. It's potent. It carries a lot of one thing.
Like turmeric, there's some great...
Yes.
Cinnamon.
Cinnamon, yeah.
And, well... Licorice root, I always say root, I gotta say, think about this root. Licorice root, glycerea, is a compound which makes the membranes of your cells relatively, less permissible to influenza viruses A or B when they come and knock it.
What happens if you hate licorice?
You take it in capsules. You can't eat licorice. If you eat licorice, you won't get it. It has to come from the licorice root, and you have to get it extracted, and you put it in capsule form. I'll admit I take that every morning, even though we're not in influenza season. Some pretty eloquent stuff. Wasn't that in Nature, or was that in Science?
Lancet.
It was in Lancet. It was really eloquent paper, and they showed you the electron microscopy of the cell membrane and what that did and how it protected. I mean, it's...
Well, oregano is supposed to be a body disinfectant that keeps your intestines intact.
Well,
kills.
I don't know about oregano. You can go down any one of these, and they have their own story to tell you.
But you can't refine it.
You refine it, it's done, baby. You go in there and try to extract it, it's over. You aren't going to get the benefit, and you run a risk that you're going to do something bad. So, again, I'm a broken record going over and over again. Eat a lot of fruits and a lot of vegetables. Get as many different ones as you can in a day. Guess what? They have your satiety center in your brain. Those guys get in there with the fiber they have and everything. They'll stop you. You can't overeat. They will tell you, your brain will tell you to stop. You're full. But you can eat 10 donuts before you're going to get there. If you do. Because it doesn't trigger it. It doesn't have the same chemical stops that go up to your satiety center.
And now they're saying that... High fructose is
glycoli. Well, high fructose has many problems. It is a bad actor of gargantuan conditions, and if you drink sweetened soda pop, you're getting it.
Yeah.
You are getting it. and go look at the fruit juices that you might get in the store. Don't drink the juice. Eat the vegetable. Or if you're going to drink the juice, buy the oranges, have a juicer, and do it right there. Or make a, in the morning, you can make a, I call it slurpee, you guys are going to call it smoothie. Get four or five different fruits, put it in your blender. They're frozen is best, unless you have really, it's even, frankly, better than your stuff in the grocery store because it's been trucked in and you don't know how long it's been in the refrigerator. The frozen stuff, especially if you get certain organic companies, they pick it from the field and it's brought in immediately where it's processed and frozen. So it's usually frozen within 24 hours of being picked, oftentimes within 6 hours. And that preserves the most of these nutrients in an unperturbed state. Yeah?
Can you tell us the rest of the story about the blood oranges?
Look what came up next. Providential. Who would have thunk? Well, my experience, I lost 13 pounds, and then I ran out of blood oranges.
Well, I was going to say, I can't get any more this week.
Where can we?
Dorothy Lane didn't have any.
No, I know. I've been there on a daily basis.
My husband and I wiped them out. I had tracked our weight for 10 days.
That's where they all went.
But see, I took it for.
He lost more than I did.
I took.
But I'm always
in the case. I've been probably a month. I've been taking it before I told you guys. And I lost 13 pounds. But I have to be honest with you. I thought I was eating just the same amount, but maybe I wasn't. And here's the bottom line for me. Let's suppose it's all placebo, which means just the fact of me eating the orange made me think that I was going to lose weight, so I did. I don't care. 13 pounds is 13 pounds. I couldn't care less. That works for me.
Doesn't it produce an awful lot? How much did you have to eat per day?
I only eat one orange a day. I have to be honest with you. I wasn't wildly excited about the blood oranges we get up here have been trucked, and they're dry, and they are. It's an act of love to put them down. If you go down to Southern California, as Dr. Webster was 2 weeks ago, where they are grown, outside of San Diego, and they're big and juicy, and they're really. He says they're absolutely delightful. But I have yet to experience one of those because I only was here for the whole time and I got a truck in. Anyway, this is a paper that prompted that. It was from the International Journal of Obesity and it was published in December of 2009. Excuse me. It was to analyze the effect of the juice obtained from two varieties of sweet oranges, the citrus and the L. Osbeck. Moro, a blood orange, and Mavali, a blonde orange, on fat accumulation in mice fed a standard or high-fat diet. Okay, so one of them got a standard diet, the other group got a high-fat diet, and they said, we're going to add in some of this different orange juice, which is caloric, into all of these different groups and see what happens, keeping a control group for each. And obesity was induced in male C57 B16 mice by feeding a high fat diet. Moral and Navelina juices were provided instead of water. So now, you know, these guys are going to have to drink. I don't know how they survive because juice has got such a high osmolarity, and what you need is for the extracellular fluid is water. So you're not getting a lot of water here. You're getting more osmoles than you are. You're making the problem worse. It's sort of like drinking salt water, which is, you know, you can read about what happens there. Somehow these guys survive, so I don't know. I can't tell you why. The effect of anthocyanine, a rich extract from moro oranges, or purified cyanidine-3 glucoside, was also analyzed. Body weight and food intake were measured regularly over a 12-week period. The adipose pads were weighted and analyzed histologically. Total RNA was also isolated for microarray analysis. Results, dietary supplementation of moro juice, but not Navelina juice, significantly reduced body weight gain and fat accumulation regardless of the increased energy intake because of the sugar content. Well, it's the moral is the blood orange.
Now, it's interesting because they also studied this, what they thought was the active ingredient alone, which is the cyanide.
They thought that the anthocyanine was the active ingredient, so they said, well, we'll take that out and we're going to feed it to them, see what happens. Only the anthocyanine extract, furthermore, mice drinking Moro juice were resistant to the high-fat diet-induced obesity with no alterations of food intake. Okay, so if they were getting the blood orange juice, they see, no matter even that they got more calories than the control group who didn't, they were fed more calories to begin with, but on top of that, they even got more calories in the fruit juice because the control group was just given the normal amount of calories and no juice. So they got a double load, okay? They showed less weight gain than the control group. They had more calories, but they gained less weight. And then they put them on the high-fat diet, and the same, they took both groups and they put them on the high-fat diet, says, okay, we're going to fatten them up. The group that didn't have the Moro juice really fatted up nicely. The guys who were on the blood oranges did gain weight, but not near as much. So that's in a nutshell the study. Does that work that way in humans? I don't know. That's why I threw it out. I wanted everyone to try it. I wanted people to come in here pirouetting through that door and say, I lost 40 pounds. I've had to go and buy all new clothes. It's been wonderful. And I only ate the oranges for 1 week.
Carol bought them all, so we couldn't get anything.
Yeah. She cornered the market. Did she try to resell it to you at a small profit?
I did find some admire.
Admire.
The one I go to is the one that's over on or resistant. Just off stream. So that's been a little over a week ago, so I've only had three oranges, so I can't say much for anything about it.
Well, the guys who had the blood oranges were resistant to obesity. In other words, they got more calories than they both got their calorie intake increased, but they got theirs increased another 15% with the juice, roughly speaking. And they still gave, the weight gain was significantly less than the other group that did not have them. Now, they tried to give them, to take out this anthocyanine and just give it to them instead of the Moro orange juice, and it didn't work. So again, there's something else in that blood orange. You need at least another component, probably three or four, in the right amounts, as yet unidentified, and you need to get it as a package or it doesn't work for the mice. It may not work for humans. We don't know. I'm sure some astute person has already got a study going somewhere where they're probably in California where they have ready access to these oranges where they're probably doing this. We can't. But I was throwing that out just as a curiosity because I wanted to get some other guinea pigs besides myself to go out and give this a shot. But, you know, best... And this, we're within, I can see the finish line is just around the corner, so we're almost there. Instead of reading this to you again and then having to translate this, let me tell you the story real quickly. They took 60 men, put 30 in a control group and 30 in an experimental group. These are men that were over 70 and had developed a prostate cancer. And you rate prostate cancer by something called a Gleason scale. Gleason's named after a guy by the name of Gleason. What you do is you take two biopsies of the prostate, you put it onto a slide, you look at it under a microscope, and they have certain criteria which include how many nuclei are in a state where they're dividing. They put a stain on, you can tell when their nuclei are dividing, and they count up how many per square millimeter, and a number of other things, they come up with a scale. So, if you have a Gleason scale of 3 or less, you're precancerous, you're probably not cancerous, but you're almost there. From 4 to 6, you do have a low-grade cancer. That means it's not wildly dividing. It's definitely cancer. It's out of control, but it's not something that's going to just explode on you. And then if you have 7 to 10, you do have a more active. And 9 and 10, you've got a very bad actor. You need to get to that one and get it taken care of. Well, in this case, they took what they thought was safe, and it was. They took... When men develop prostate, get diagnosed with prostate cancer at the age of 70, they're probably going to die of something else out of the prostate, unless it's a 9 or a 10 Gleason scale. So these guys had a 4, 5, or 6 reading on their Gleason scale. So they were what was considered to be a highly malignant tumor. And what they did is they took all 60 had opted to do nothing about their cancer. They said, you know, we're going to die of something else. We don't want to be treated for it. And that's very acceptable because the vast majority of them will die of something else, not from their cancer. And what they did was they took 30 of those guys that agreed in this study that were put in the experimental group, and they tried to match them as best they could with other risk factors. But, you know, with only 30, that's going to be probably something you could argue against this in a way. You could say, well, you didn't do enough. You should have had 150 in each one. But that's one area where you might be able to legitimately criticize this study. But otherwise, I think when I show you this, the PATH slides here in a minute, you're going to see why I think this is such a good paper. By Dean Ornish, you know, the guy who wrote the first book in 1990 about myocardial health. And anyway, he's at UCLA. Anyway, what they did was they took the control group and they said, okay, we're going to put you on a plant-based diet. You aren't going to smoke. You're not going to drink alcohol. We're going to ask that you do an exercise a day. And I forget if they had them walk a mile or if they had to walk for so many minutes. I forget what it was. But they had to get exercise at least 4 to 5 times a week. Preferably daily, but a minimum of 4 to 5 times a week. And they had to go to, I think it was 2 times a week, they had to go to a group therapy session where they could talk and commiserate with each other that they had prostate cancer and have fellowship. And the reason being that that would be something that would lower the anxiety and the angst that they have cancer. You know what I mean? The other group got none of that. What they said was, guys, go home, come back in 3 months, and we will talk to you then, okay? Just go on doing whatever you're doing. And, you know, don't do anything new or different. Just go home and be yourselves. Now, all of them had prostate biopsies that were done right at the beginning of the experiment. And they took those, put them into the refrigerator, and said, into the freezer, we're going to keep those and see what happens. When they came back in 3 months, what they did was they said, okay, let's go in and re-biopsy their prostate, and let's do some genetic analysis, and let's look at some any changes in enzymatic activities, and see if there was any difference. 3 months. Remember I told you for blood oranges, you probably need to be doing it at least a month, probably 2, since we're working on it. I forgot to mention that in the rats, they feel like it is working on a certain gene in the rats. Whatever the chemicals are in the blood orange, yet to be identified. So whenever you're dealing with genetics, it's not something that happens usually overnight. You've got to give it a little bit of time. So when they came back, this is what they found. Let me just show you the pictures. Here is a list of... This is a unigene or genome database name, and over here is the mRNA classification of stuff that was coming out that they found in the cells of the biopsy of both groups before they started them on the experimental regimen. And after the guys now who came back, who had been on the experimental regimen, what they found was that... there was either up-regulation or down-regulation in the pre- and post-diet lifestyle intervention in normal prostate in their prostate biopsy samples. All of these changed in the group that was the experimental group. There was change in none of these in the control group. The control group were the ones that just went home and didn't do anything. So they found lots of changes. So they said, well, let's go in and let's analyze this further. And you can't see it here, and I don't have a red pointer, but right down the middle here, you see this line where the two colors change? This was in the experimental group. This was when they did a special,
This is an array.
A spectral array. Is it the northern or southern?
No, this is just a genome array.
Just the genome array.
Right. Mm-hmm. It tells which genes are active and which ones aren't. The red means that they're upregulated.
And the green means they're downregulated.
Downregulated. So, okay. Yeah.
So, you see all the red here? This was pre going on the plant-based diet and all the, and having a touchy-feely session twice a week and all that other stuff, okay? And this was post. Over 400 different proteins were greatly diminished or absent in the cancer cells in the post-treatment experimental group that had been present before, and 57 proteins that hadn't been present before were now present. Over 300 genes were upregulated or downregulated. None of that occurred in the control group. All of the genes associated with the change were what I would lump together in one generalization. They helped the body stop the cancer or tried to stop the cell that was cancerous from acting so cancerous.
That's
so, plant-based diet makes a big difference if you have cancer. Well, first of all, if it makes a big difference if you have cancer, do you think it would make a difference if you didn't have cancer and you went on it? Now, I didn't have time tonight to bring in the anecdotal stories of people who had advanced cancer who were told, go home, you're going to die in 6 months, get your house in order, and went on a raw diet. My wife and daughter are going raw. I was there last week and I went raw for a week. And you have a lot more energy. I'll tell you, that's probably, if it was placebo, I don't care. I like it. But these people, there's many anecdotal stories. I could just give you, because I spent the whole time tonight, just one after another, of people who go on a raw diet and are either able to put their cancer in remission or completely have it gone. Does that mean everyone that takes a raw diet is going to beat their cancer? No.
Are you eating legumes?
Pardon?
Are you eating legumes?
Well, what you do is, I did, you had some.
Raw legumes?
We're not talking about green beans.
Oh, no. What you can do to be raw, you can't go over 118 degrees because that's when the proteins start denaturizing. That means they start unwinding and breaking. And if you keep it below 110, you're definitely safe. You have not essentially taken the product and altered it because of the heat. So what my daughter did was she put this in a crock pot that went all night at 110. And if you go for 12 hours, those beans you can chew them. They taste like you would expect if you had put them in and done it over a short period of time and it got them to the same place.
And a pressure cooker is no good.
No, I think a pressure cooker will do worse for you. I think that's under a pressure. You're really putting the heat to them. You're going to denature those. I'm guessing. I've not done a study. Maybe someone knows here can answer that. But my guess is that would not get you where you want to go. One last thing. I'm not going to go into this long. This is, I went through and I found a lot of literature. Mike, he gave me about six or seven multiples, a stack of the, went to get the literature that might be pro-meat, okay? I thought this is going to be interesting because there is, a ton of information against it. So I thought, well, good. Now we're going to see what the other side has to say. And they said a high protein, high red meat versus high carbohydrate weight loss diets do not differ in the effect on genome stability and cell death in lymphocytes of overweight men. And they go on to say, there is no significant effect of time or diet for nuclear division index, a biomarker of immune response. The results suggest that the effect of the high-protein weight loss diet on DNA damage measured using, and they give you an assay, and the the blood lymphocytes, right? Yeah. It's they've not differentiated that there early. Was not different from that observed in the high carbohydrate weight loss diet. Okay, what they said is we're going to go out and we're going to look at some lymphocytes in men who are trying to lose weight. One group are going to eat meat, and the other ones are going to eat a high-carbohydrate diet. I don't know how you lose weight on a high-carbohydrate diet. They don't tell you how that occurs. So right there, I've got some questions about this study. Plus the fact that it was in a publication I've never heard of before. It's called Mutagenesis, and it was published in 2009. I just have not, it's not Science, Scientific American, or Nature, or the North American, I mean, the National Academy of Sciences. Those are the places we like to troll for papers, and so this one's, I just hadn't heard of before. Anyway, what they said was, we're going to go out, we're going to go and look at their lymphocytes and see if they're dividing more, and that would be an indication that they were, well, that there wasn't an inflammatory process, that there was no difference in inflammatory process going on. But then they didn't do, you know, we talked about the fact that smoking causes inflammatory process, drinking does, a number of other things were not controlled for in this. So, anyway. And at the end of the paper, when it came out, it was making a straw man argument and then cutting it down, because the way those lymphocytes divide, it has nothing to do with uramic acid, it has nothing to do with transposable elements, it has nothing to do with cholesterol and high fat content, and eating a lot of arachidonic acid, which is an animal fat, which is a precursor for all of the bad chemical messengers that go out and tell your body there's inflammation going on, like cytokines and leukotrienes and all that sort of stuff. They didn't look at any of that. They just wanted to see if a certain set of lymphocytes, if the DNA looked like they were dividing more frequently than the group that had the high carbohydrate diet. And when they said it didn't, they said, see, meat in low amounts is fine. That was their conclusion. Then they said, look under the conflict of interest statement, none declared. But then they, under the acknowledgement right above it, it says, we thank the volunteers who participated in the study and the CSIRO clinic and laboratory staff for assistance and performance of the study and the sample collection. Whoops, I'm sorry, I got to read the funding here. And the funding, look where the funding is. Look who funded it. Now, do you think that they would allow that paper to be published if the authors hadn't been able to find something that was the same in the two diets that they could then put on an unsuspecting public who wouldn't know the difference anyway about whether or not lymphocytes dividing or not meant that it was healthy? I don't think the Meat and Livestock of Australia medical research grant, I don't think they'd let it have been printed if they'd come up with any results that would have been deleterious to their cause. And this paper means nothing. It doesn't look at any of the critical areas, not one. And this is what I found in all the papers. I put this one up as an example of the literature that's out to defend it. Almost invariably, it's paid for by the Ireland Beef Council, or it's put out by the Texas Beef Council, or the Meat and Livestock of Australia, and all the papers are rubbish. They create straw man arguments and demolish them. And so if someone is looking for something to support their meat addiction, they've got these papers, but they're no different than the papers that came out in the 1950s that showed that smoking was okay. Philip Morris funded many a paper with very prestigious researchers who were bought off, let's call this spade a spade, to come up with papers that ingeniously would look at the wrong markers, and they would look at markers that had nothing to do with what was really causing the problem with smoking and show that those markers stayed the same. With meat, we are where we were with cigarette smoking in the 40s and 50s as far as what these guys are putting out. It's the same game. New faces, but the game's the same. And this is just another one, and I'm going to here's the acknowledgement on this paper. It was likewise equally as scientifically rigorous. It says the present review was supported by funding from the Department of Employment and Learning, Cooperative Awards in Science and Technology, AgriSearch, and Livestock and Meat Commission of Northern Ireland. Go back to almost every one of these papers that say meat eating is okay. They always coach it by saying, well, in small amounts or in moderate amounts, there appears to be no difference between eating meat, and they'll pick another diet, which is grossly unhealthful, and then they'll look at a couple of markers that really don't even look at what we talked about at all. They don't come close to what we talked about tonight, and they say, therefore, it's okay. The world today is full of pain, suffering, and agony, but is the will of God that such a condition shall exist? No. God, the creator of our bodies, has arranged every fiber and nerve and sinew and muscle, and has pledged himself to keep the machinery in order if the human agent will cooperate with him and refuse to work contrary to the laws which govern the physical system. And I had, I mercifully didn't tell Mike, because he makes my slides. I made a couple myself, and they were the bad ones. Interesting. I'm just going to throw a question out to you. I had some ways I was going to set it up, but I'm not going to be cute about it. I'm just going to tell you. I have a question for you. Do you think that Daniel, remember the three worthies, and when they were taken to Nebuchadnezzar and they were offered to eat at his table, which back in those days was nothing but meat. There weren't even any vegetables there, but they had multiple types of meat. Every one of them, of course, produced by Nebuchadnezzar's chefs and wine. That's what they were given to drink. And Daniel and the three worthies, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, said, no, we don't want any of that. Rightly so, because it had been offered to gods, and then anything that they might have done afterwards would have been attributed to the gods of Babylon, because, look, that's whose table they ate on. But what if the mere fact, go back and see what they read, ate fruits and vegetables, is the same nuts, but I'll bet you they had some nuts too, or they would have been down. Some problems. It wasted away. What if, yes, God blessed them because they used the plan, the program, the systems that he already had placed in humans, and they optimized it? And when they optimized the plan they already had that was already there, they ended up being 10 times on test, on examination day, they did 10 times better than any of the other candidates who were pulled in from around the world. Yes, they have to have had a genetic background. They could not have probably come from parents who had an IQ of 60. I'll grant you that. There was definitely genes involved here. I'm not taking that out of the picture. But guess what? All the other candidates were picked from their countries because they were deemed to be the smartest too. So it was this, it was the college bowl of the smartest of the smartest. So none of these guys were coming in, they probably, the story of Daniel, outdid their opponents. They didn't just double them, they just didn't lap them once. They didn't lap them three times. They cleaned their clock. It wasn't close. God's law is written by his own finger upon every nerve and muscle, every faculty which has been entrusted to man. These gifts were bestowed upon him, not to be abused, corrupted in it, and abased, but to be used in his honor and glory. Every misuse of any part of our organism is a violation of the law which God designs shall govern us in these matters. And by violating this law, human beings corrupt themselves, sickness and disease of every kind, ruin constitutions, premature decay, untimely deaths. These are the results of a violation of God's laws. We'll skip that one. Eating the flesh of dead animals has an injurious effect upon spirituality. When meat is made the staple article of food, the higher faculties are overborne by the lower passions. These things are an offense to God and the cause of a decline in spiritual life. Whatever we do in the line of eating and drinking should be done with the special purpose of nourishing the body, that we may serve God to his name's glory. The whole body is a property of God, and we must give strict attention to our physical well-being, for the religious life is closely related to physical habits and practices. I always, when I was growing up, I heard people talking and debating about the fact that there was a statement from Ellen White that says that if you want to be one of the 44,000, you can't eat meat. And then the debate would start. Well, how do you know, back and forth, and what have you, and air this, that, and the other thing. Well, I'm going to suggest something to you. Maybe there's a reason. Maybe the... Oh, I'm not going to do that one. That would be heresy. So let me back up. Maybe the reason that the 144,000 aren't going to have any meat eaters is not because God is saying, Harumph, I said no meat. And you knew that. So you're out. And I'm just going to keep these people in, no matter how miserable they may be. I'm going to have they did the obedience thing. Yeah, but should we maybe be obeying him because he tells the truth and he knows what reality is? And when he makes a statement, it's not arbitrary. He's telling you what the facts are in the situation. You're free to go with the facts or not go with the facts. But guess what? With what's coming for the 144,000, if you don't have your top game mentally and physically, you aren't going to make it. It's not arbitrary. It's not, well, if you didn't do this or you didn't do that, so you're out of the game. It's, sorry, you can't play in the big leagues if you didn't train. No one's going to be allowed to be in the final game that isn't equipped. And if you don't have your top game mentally, you will not have your top game spiritually. And maybe Psalms 91, which says that 10,000 will fall at your right hand, 1,000 will fall at your left hand, but the plague will not come nigh thy dwelling, is because you haven't been eating a source of 5GC, which makes you very vulnerable to a biotoxin which happened to be created in eggs or swine. Did you ever think of that? And those who are eating it are going to get weeded out. Not because God says, well, you didn't obey me, so you guys... You're going to see what I meant, what I was saying, and well, you're going to get zapped. Or is he telling you the way the conditions are going to be, and if you're going to be able to make through it, this is reality, and this is what you're going to have to do to make it. Is anything short of that in your mind? So now the statement that it's purely arbitrary, that only non-meat-eaters will be translated, doesn't arbitrary at all anymore. It's simply telling you the conditions that are going to exist. If you're going to survive in them, you've got to meet certain specifications. And I've implanted in you the ability to make those specifications, but you have to do your part. If you don't want to do your part, that's fine, but you can't play in the final inning. Right physical habits promote mental superiority. They just don't... Remember the original picture I had of the couple who looked like they were as miserable as they could be and they were as old as dirt? And I said, this is what Woody Allen, remember the statement, if you want to live to be 100, you have to give up everything that would make you want to. Remember that was the first slide I put up there? He's 100% wrong. Because people on a plant-based diet, which you can go read the China study, are way less likely to have Alzheimer's disease or senile dementia, way less likely to have cancer, and way less likely to have a stroke. Guess what? Strokes are bad news. Dementia, you don't know you're sick. So every day is a new day. Everybody you meet is new. You're as happy as can be. You have no clue. You're not even in left field. You left the stadium. You're happy. You've ever seen those people that have a stroke? And you have to be in a wheelchair. And you can't talk. And you can't take care of your bodily functions. Now that's a loser game. That game you want to stay away from at all costs. How are you going to make your best chance of staying away from that game? Do eat a plant-based diet. Forget the don'ts. I'll tell you what to do. There's lots of don'ts. Mental superiority. intellectual power, physical strength, and longevity depend upon immutable laws. So if you want to live to be old and enjoy it, there's only one way in the game you're going to do it. One, plant-based diet. And I'll leave you with the happy couple that were, like they've been eating cardboard, and Woody Allen's statement. I put this one on the board. I'm going to end with this one. We've gone full circle and said, if you will diligently listen to the voice of the Lord your God and will do that which is right in His sight and will give ear to His commandments and keep all His statutes, I will put none of these diseases on you which I have brought upon the Egyptians, for I am the Lord that heals. I think that's just as true today as it was 4,000 years ago. The systems we have are the same systems they did, albeit we've got a lot more transposable elements and we've got a lot more problems than they probably did. But now that makes it even more necessary that we put the right ingredients in to keep our machinery working well. Because we are actually at a greater detriment than they were. But I don't think this promise is any less in force. And we're not going to worry about that. Okay, I'm going to do one more time now, and I want you to look at this. I showed it at the end of the prior lectures. I'm going to show it again. But I think after what we've discussed today, the last two times around, you will have a better appreciation of the incredible, ingenious detail that has gone into each one of your 100 trillion cells. They are a work of art beyond description in technicality and the incredible things that they can do. I lose ability to give you, I run out of proper language to try to convey the incredible, intricate, and fabulous way we've been made. The psalmist said, we are
fearfully
made. That's probably the best way to go at it. You're going to see again this white blood cell and the things it has to do to get into the right between the two endothelial cells to get out. You're going to see these things that look like palm trees. Those are the glycoproteins, and on the end of those are the uramic acid that we talked about. So you can see how all of this works now, all the stuff we talked about, and the tubules that you see forming and coming, they form way faster than they form in this animation, in this normal cell, and they work just that way. This is an accurate depiction of the inside of a cell. It cost Harvard like $6 million to have this animation done from their the cell division of their biology department, School of Medicine. So let me get to see if I can go here.
Thank you.
probably occurs in each of yours and my body's probably tens to hundreds of thousands of times every day, and that occurs in about 2 or 3 seconds. It took 3 minutes to show you when it occurs in maybe just 2 or 3, 5 seconds at most. And we're just showing you the very basic essentials of it. What I got to say to you is, don't you want to provide your cells that are doing this marvelous work for you with everything you can possibly give them to do their job? Are you going to look at your eating now as something that's just to please you in the top center, or are you going to look at eating as something to provide for all of the 100 trillion cells that are depending upon you and what you're going to put down for them? They have no other way of getting at this. And they're so complicated, they're so wonderfully made. Are you going to deprive them of what is essential for them to continue to work for you? That's really what it makes it boils down to. So thank you. These lectures are now mercifully come to an end. I went way over tonight, but I figured it was the last night, so if I alienated you, so what? We're done. So thanks for coming. Thank you. I'm all out now. Yes.
Some of those items that you put up there that were quotes from Ellen White, I didn't recognize the source that's given there, like
Spalding and Mega 1985 was one you wouldn't have recognized. That was SPM.
4MR. 4MR. What's that?
I'll get it for you.
MR?
I don't remember seeing that one, but okay. I went through a word. I have her on logos, and I can just type in words, and the stuff comes up, and I just copy it and put it on the slide, and I sometimes don't. It has the where it's found next to it, but I didn't go to the book. This was computer generated, so I didn't actually go to the different books. So that's why I'm going to have trouble telling you exactly which one needs.
Articles and papers that she wrote as
well. Signs of the Times. Those are usually. These are usually compilations that you aren't acquainted with. I looked at one. I thought SPM. I've never seen that before. S small PM, and it's Spalding and Megan. Collection of 1985. I don't know who they are. They obviously got into the White Estate and got into some of her letters or some of her correspondence and pulled this stuff out. So I will try to look up MR for you, because I picked it up off of my, you know, I've got all of her writings on my computer, and I got a logo system, and I type in words, and it goes and gets me paragraphs, and this is good. And put it. There's no way I can read all these books and be able to come up with this and still dally on the scientific literature, which I want to do. So, okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yep. Thank you.